Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to start by talking about the meeting of the Fed at Jackson Hole on August 23rd. This is a big, important meeting going forward because Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, is announcing whether, in fact, there will be future interest rate cuts. So, we're going to read an article entitled, What You Need to Know About the Fed's Big Jackson Hole Meeting. Financial market headlines right now are dominated by the talk of Jackson Hole. Why it matters. Jackson Hole is shorthand for an annual gathering of central bankers in Wyoming that inevitably makes big-time economic news. To set the scene, here are the basics you need to know about the events and what makes it worthy of so much attention. First question, what is this thing? The Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City has hosted its annual economic symposium in a lodge in Grand Teton National Park since 1982. It's a gathering of central bankers from around the world. It also includes academics, other influential economic thinkers, policymakers, and journalists. The meat of the event consists of a series of papers on important economic ideas related to the year's topic, this year. It is reassessing the effectiveness and transmission of monetary policy. Fed Chair Jerome Powell will speak first thing Friday morning, that is 8 a.m. local time. Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey is also on tap, scheduled to speak later Friday. What will Powell say? Traditionally, the federal chair uses the Jackson Hole speech to deliver a particularly important and long-range message. In the past, Powell has seen this venue as a chance to lay out an intellectual framework for policy, rather than tactical signaling of his next policy move. For example, his 2018 Guided by the Stars speech was perhaps his most memorable as chair. It outlined how he thinks about important but unmeasurable variables, like the natural rate of interest and the natural rate of unemployment. But right now, with the central bank poised to begin cutting rates next month, this year's speech will be scrutinized for more immediate policy implications. The pre-announced topic of Powell's speech is simply the economic outlook, which doesn't exactly narrow things down. In particular, traders will be looking for hints of whether the Fed is likely to ease policy gradually and cautiously, or is sufficiently worried about the state of the job market that rapid rate cuts are a real possibility. Why Jackson Hole? In the early 1980s, the Kansas City Fed leaders learned that the best way to ensure Fed Chairman Paul Volcker would accept an invitation was to locate the event somewhere with good fly fishing in late August. Jackson Hole it was. Four decades later, the symposium has become entrenched as the premier event on the Fed's annual calendar, in no small part through network effects. Influential policymakers and thinkers want to be there because they know other influential policymakers and thinkers will be there. It also helps that the setting is gorgeous. The weather is usually great, and the Kansas City Fed has done an excellent job over the years of curating the topics, papers, and guest lists. What's the scene like? The event does not take place in some luxury resort. It's at a lodge in a national park that remains open to the public and features a big grizzly bear taxidermy in the lobby. The rooms are decidedly rustic. It's not uncommon to see powerful economic policymakers from Europe or Asia wandering the hotel lobby, amid American tourists who pulled up on motorcycles or in RVs. Some attendees fully embrace the Western vibe, wearing cowboy hats, boots, and the like. Others stick to the more traditional business casual attire. Behind closed doors at the symposium itself, things are considerably more intimate than at many economic conferences. The guest list, constrained by the size of the ballroom where the gathering takes place, is a bit over 100. After a long day of economy talk and maybe an afternoon hike, attendees usually go to a Friday dinner with Western-themed entertainment, such as a live show by a horse whisperer. Who's there? The list of attendees this year has not yet been released, but in the past, the lineup has included most Fed governors and Reserve Bank presidents, as well as the governor or top deputy from dozens of other global central banks, top economists from international organizations, and the current U.S. administration, leading academic and private sector economists. What will make news? The biggest headlines are likely to come from Powell's speech, but the papers presented and the discussions they spur can create their own fireworks. The Kansas City Fed publishes the papers on its website. The presentation and discussions are not broadcast, except for Powell's speech this year, but the proceedings in the room are on the record, and economics journalists, including yours truly, are on hand to report what they hear. So why is this gathering special? There's something unique about the beauty of the setting and the repetition of seeing many of the same people in the same place year after year. The smallness of the conference contributes to its intimacy. Most importantly, there is a sense that it is where important moments in modern economic history have taken place. It's cool to be in the room when history happens. Now here's an article on what Jerome Powell said at Jackson Hole. The title of the article is Powell at Jackson Hole. The time has come for the Fed to soon begin reducing interest rates. With inflation defeated and the job market cooling, the Federal Reserve is prepared to start cutting key interest rates from its current 23-year high, Chair Jerome Powell said on Friday. Powell did not say when rate cuts would begin or how large they might be, but the Fed is widely expected to announce a modest quarter-point cut in its rate when it begins in mid-September. The time has come for policy to adjust, said Powell in his keynote speech at the Fed's annual economic conference in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. The rate of travel is clear, and the timing and the pace of interest cuts will depend on incoming data, the evolving outlook, and the balance of risks. His reference to multiple rate cuts was the only hint that a series of reductions is likely. Powell stated that inflation, after the worst price spike in four decades, inflicted pain on millions of households, appears largely under control. According to the Fed's preferred measure, inflation fell to 2.5% last month, far below its peak of 7.1% 2 years ago, and only slightly above the central rate's 2% goal. My confidence has grown, he said. The inflation is on a sustainable path back to 2%. Powell's assessment signaled that the Fed is making a fundamental shift from its 2.5-year rate increase tactic against inflation toward a broader effort to keep the economy growing and employers hiring. The Fed's chair's assurance that rate cuts were coming helped fuel a rally on Wall Street. Bond yields and stock indexes were broadly higher. The only question remaining for the September 8th meeting is, how much will the Fed be cutting rates? Joseph Lavorgna, chief economist at SMBC Nikko Securities, said. The outcome of the August employment report, which will be reported September 6, Lavorgna stated, is obviously critical. If that report shows a second straight month of weak hiring, the Fed may decide to cut the key rate by a more aggressive half point. Most economists expect the Fed to cut its benchmark rate by a quarter point at each of its final three meetings this year. Wall Street traders, though, foresee a 1 in 3 likelihood that the Fed's cut will be a half point at one of these meetings, according to future prices. A lower Fed benchmark may lead to eventually lower rates for auto loans, mortgages, and other forms of consumer borrowing. It could also boost stock prices. In his remarks on Friday, the Fed chair suggested that rate cuts could help extend that much sought-after soft landing, whereby inflation falls back to the Fed's 2% target without a recession occurring. Continued growth could boost Vice President Kamala Harris's presidential campaign, even as Americans state that they're dissatisfied with the Biden-Harris's administration's economic record. because average consumer prices remained far above where they were before the pandemic. "We'll do everything we can," Powell said, "to support a stronger labor market as we make progress toward price stability." By cutting rates, he said, there's a good reason to think the economy will get back to 2% while maintaining a strong labor market. A rate cut in mid-September, coming less than 2 months before the presidential election, could bring some unwelcome political heat on the Fed, which seeks to avoid becoming entangled in election politics. Former President Donald Trump has argued that the Fed shouldn't cut rates so close to the election. But Powell has repeatedly underscored that the central bank could make its rate deceleration based purely on economic data, without regard to the political calendar. In his remarks, Powell said the Fed has grown concerned about slower hiring and a rising unemployment rate, even while it still wants to see inflation fall further. That dual focus is represented in the Fed's previous singular focus on inflation. "The cooling in the labor market conditions is unmistakable," the Fed chair said. "Job gains remain positive but have slowed this year. We don't seek or welcome further cooling in labor market conditions." In what amounted to something of a victory lap, Powell noted that the Fed had succeeded in conquering high inflation without causing a recession or a sharp rise in unemployment, which economists had long predicted. The soft landing did come as a big surprise to the economics profession. Gaudi Egertson, economist at Brown University, said during a presentation Friday at the Jackson Hole Conference, and attributed that outcome to the unraveling of the pandemic's disruptions to supply chains and labor markets and a reduction in job vacancies, which allowed wage growth to cool. Powell noted that according to surveys and financial market gauges, Americans never really expected high inflation to stick. Such expectations can become self-fulfilling. If the people expect inflation to remain high, they typically demand ever higher pay or they accelerate their purchase before prices can rise further. These steps can perpetuate higher inflation. But inflation expectations rose only modestly and have since largely fallen back to pre-pandemic levels. The healing from the pandemic distortions, the Fed's rate hikes, and the fact that Americans did expect higher inflation have worked together to put inflation on what increasingly appears to be a sustainable path to our 2% objective, the Fed chair said. Powell also addressed criticism that the Fed was too slow to raise rates, even after inflation had been surging once the pandemic recession ended. Fed officials had initially argued that prices coming out of the pandemic in early 2021 were merely transitory and were soon fade as the chain disruptions left some grocery shelves bare and auto lots empty had healed. Powell acknowledged that the healing of supply disruptions took much longer than the Fed had expected, and so did the persistence of high inflation. The good ship transitory was a crowded one, with most mainstream analysts and advanced economic central bankers on board, he said. "I think I see some shipmates out there today," he said in an ad-lib remark addressed to the economists and central bankers assembled for the conference. Separately, Andrew Bailey, governor of the Bank of England, expressed some optimism that in the United Kingdom, inflation is also steadily declining. But Bailey took a much more cautious approach than Powell about what the central bank may do next. Earlier this month, the Bank of England cut its rate for the first time in 4 years. Bailey said the UK will likely be able to tame inflation without a jump in employment or a dip in the economy, but he did warn that inflation wasn't fully defeated. "It's too early to declare victory," he said. "We need to be cautious because the job is not completely done." Next, we're going to talk about how consumers feel about the state of the economy. Here's an article from Yahoo Finance. Consumers enter the final stretch of 2024 campaign with a somewhat cheerier outlook on the economy. Here are the two key takeaways from the article. Consumers felt better about the economy in August. Expectations for inflation a year from now eased slightly. Consumer confidence improved slightly in August as Americans balanced more optimism about the economy's prospects, while also exhibiting worries about the labor market. The Consumer Confidence Index from the Confidence Board rose to 103.3, while the reading for July was revised upward to 101.9 from 100.3 previously. Both the present situation and future expectation indices improved. Consumers continued to express mixed feelings in August, said Dana Patterson, chief economist at the business organization. Compared to July, they're more positive about business conditions, both current and future, but also more concerned about the labor market. Consumers' assessment of the current labor market, while still positive, continued to weaken, and the assessments of the labor market going forward were more pessimistic, Peterson added. This likely reflects the recent increase in unemployment. Consumers were also a bit less positive about future income. The report comes at an important time for the economy, with the Federal Reserve set to begin lowering interest rates at its next meeting in September, and it also comes as the 2024 presidential election heats up, with both President Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump targeting the economy, though each is proposing quite different ideas on the topic. And the index continues to show differing perspectives depending on the age and the income of the respondents. In August, confidence declined among consumers under 35, while it increased for those 35 and older, Peterson said. On a six-month moving average basis, confidence remained the highest among young consumers. Despite all the overall improvement in the headline index, confidence declined for consumers earning less than $25,000. On a six-month moving average basis, consumers earning over $100,000 remained most confident. Confidence among consumers earning $15,000 to $24,900 continued to trend down and was almost as low as those for earning less than $15,000. Inflation expectations fell slightly, with consumers believing prices will rise over next year at a 4.9 rate, well above the current 2.9% level as indicated by July's Consumer Price Index. Still, the number is the lowest since March 2020, when COVID-19 set off a sharp increase in prices. Interestingly, although many surveys of consumers over the past couple of years have shown distinct differences based on political persuasion, in August, write-in responses, the share of respondents believing the 2024 elections would impact the economy was stable at slightly above 2020 levels, but well below the August 2016 level. Chief economist Gregory Dako said the early August volatility in the stock market is not changing the behavior of consumers, and indeed, the Dow Jones Industrial Average posted a new high on Monday. Business leaders and consumers are not retrenching, and financial market volatility is more a reflection of the Federal Reserve being behind the curve in terms of easing policy than reflective of any fundamental economic weakness, Dako said. This is positive as Fed policy easing in the coming months should support the economy and reduce financial market volatility. We foresee real GDP growth averaging 2.5% in 2024 and easing to 1.7% in 2025. Separately, the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price Index reached a new high in June after a 5.4% rate of annual increase. That rise was slightly below the 5.9% a month earlier. New York posted the highest gains at 9% year over year, with San Diego at 8.7% and Las Vegas following at 8.5%. The housing market is being affected by high prices, limited inventory, and elevated mortgage rates, though those have dipped slightly in recent weeks as the Fed signals that it will be cutting interest rates soon. We expect the rate of home price growth to slow somewhat further, said Realtor.com chief economist Danielle Hale. In fact, the Realtor.com 2024 forecast update projects growth of just 4.6% for the coming year, even though the number of homes on the market for sales trails 2017 to 2019 levels by 30%, the number of home sales has remained quite low. In the face of sluggish demand, today's low but quickly improving for sale inventory has ushered in more market balance than would otherwise be expected, pushing up the share of sellers making price cuts, according to the Realtor.com data. This should help home prices maintain a slower rate of growth. Now we're going to change subjects completely. Here's an article entitled "Sports Gambling Takes a Toll on Americans' Checkbooks," research shows. Two new studies quantify the effect of legalized and expanded sports betting on investment and savings. Researchers have begun measuring the impact of legalized sports gambling on American households, and the initial results paint a worrisome picture about how its expansion has affected bettors' finances. In separate papers released this month, academics have found that households in states where gambling was legalized saw significantly reduced savings, as well as lower investments in assets like stocks that are generally considered more financially sound. Meanwhile, states that legalized sports betting saw their residents' aggregate credit scores decrease, while bankruptcies increased. "Legalization is not a free lunch," said Scott Baker, associate professor of finance at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, and the lead author on one of these papers. "The lunch has nevertheless been substantial for state coffers. New York, which has a 51% tax rate on mobile sports wagering, raked in $862 million last year in tax revenues from the activity, and more than $2 billion over the past 3 years, according to Legal Sports Report, with most of it going toward education. New Jersey, the first state to allow online sports betting, has a much lower tax rate, though it is contemplating an increase, but has still seen $549 million in tax receipts from sports betting since 2018. Online sports betting is legal in 30 states, plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, and the authors estimate total monthly wagers have climbed from an average of $1.1 billion per month in 2019 to $14 billion in January 2024. North Carolina just became the most recent state to offer online sports betting earlier this year. But there's been a clear cost, according to the study's authors. Using data sets showing deposits and withdrawals into and out of online sports betting platforms like FanDuel and DraftKings, as well as to and from equity brokerage accounts like Charles Schwab, E-Trade, Vanguard, and Fidelity, Baker and his authors found that legalization has led to higher credit card balances, lower access to credit, a reduction in longer-term and higher-yield investments, as well as an increase in lottery play, with the effects particularly pronounced among financially constrained households. "It's not just moving entertainment dollars from one company to another," Baker said. "Rather, they're drawing from sources of their household budget that policymakers are trying to increase, like stock investment accounts," he said. "And the effects aren't limited to the individual." Baker's team found bettors were more likely to have received pandemic-era child tax credits, regardless of income, suggesting that they were more likely to have children. In a separate study led by Brett Hollenbach, an associate professor of marketing at UCLA's Anderson School of Management, researchers found that compared with states that did not implement sports gambling, states that did so saw credit scores drop by a statistically significant, though modest, amount, while bankruptcies soared 28%, and debt transfer to debt collectors climbed 8%. Auto loan delinquencies and use of debt consolidation loans also increased, they found. While many consumers get real enjoyment from legal gambling and states benefit in the form of additional tax revenue, there is a corresponding concern that the introduction of sports gambling and the ease at which consumers can now bet online are negatively harming consumer financial health, they write. Our paper provides evidence that this concern is well-founded. The papers have not yet been peer-reviewed, but both sought to rule out other causes for the declines in household financial well-being, like national economic trends, that might have also affected household spending and investment decisions. They note instead that the timing of a given state's legalization has tended to map neatly onto the beginning of households' financial deterioration. Some state lawmakers have taken note of negative impacts. In New Jersey, Senate President Nicole Scutari recently introduced a bill that would create a gambling treatment diversion court, citing the fact that gambling expansion has created unrestrained opportunity for people with gambling or disordered gambling to become engulfed in destructive behaviors. The New York State Gambling Commission noted a 26% increase in problem gambling-related calls to the Office of Addiction Services and Supports from 2021 to 2022, the most recent period for which data has been released. Yet states continue to see gambling as a cash cow, while Adam Candy, editor-in-chief of Legal Sports Report, said it would be unfair to characterize state approaches to sports gambling legalization as a search for a panacea to their budget woes. Many are now introducing legislation to further capitalize on the growth in gambling, whether through increased tax rates or replacing existing levies with funding from gambling. Meanwhile, the industry will continue to grow, although Candy said the rate of growth will slow until California and Texas decide to legalize sports betting, and there's no sign that they will do so immediately, he said. But he said that as money continues to pour in, gambling platforms will acquire even greater leverage to try and get some form of legalized gambling passed in those states, not to mention all others as an entryway into legalized sports betting. Earlier this year, the major sports betting platforms forced the responsible online gaming association to address problem gambling. Its members have committed more than $20 million to fund research, education, and awareness campaigns, as well as to develop a clearinghouse of players who display high-risk attributes. Yet there is likely a limit to how much the platforms will seek to restrict their own activities. Unfortunately, most of the major sports books in the United States have shareholders to answer to, Candy said, noting the largest ones, including DraftKings, FanDuel, and BetMGM, are all publicly traded. And those shareholders are going to want to see growth and profit. We're going to take a quick break now. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. If you miss any part of this show, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. You can find it under Broadcast Information and Audio, then just click On Demand. Now we're going from the legalization of sports gambling to the legalization of cannabis in Florida. And make no mistake about it, both sports gambling and the continued legalization of cannabis on a state-by-state basis are very, very large sources of revenue, which makes them topics that are much more complex than you might think. With billions of dollars at stake, the Sunshine State will decide whether to legalize adult-use marijuana in November. But the ballot member has some powerful enemies, including Governor DeSantis and a hedge fund billionaire. Here's who could tip the scales either way. This November, when voters decide who will become the next president of the United States, Floridians will also have the chance to vote on whether to legalize adult-use cannabis. If the Sunshine State votes yes on Amendment 3, it will become the 25th state in the U.S. to legalize recreational use, and one of only 14 Republican ones. If the measure passes, Florida would become the first red state in the American South to legalize recreational use. Kim Rivers, the CEO of Tallahassee-based Trulieve, the state's largest cannabis company, with 143 medical marijuana dispensaries across the state, believes the importance of Florida passing adult use cannot be overstated. This is a pivotal moment in the trajectory of cannabis and ending prohibition, Rivers tells Forbes. We have an opportunity here to make a meaningful impact on the national conversation. Florida would be a very big domino to fall. With only 12 weeks before Election Day and billions of dollars at stake, the fight to legalize adult-use cannabis in Florida is too close to call. Home to the country's largest medical marijuana market, which now boasts $2 billion in annual sales, if the ballot measure passes, Florida's legal cannabis market could bloom into a $6 billion industry by 2026, according to cannabis data firm Headset. To date, Trulieve, which is also one of the country's largest legal cannabis outfits, has donated $65 million to Smart and Safe Florida over the last 2 years, the organization running the Yes on Three campaign, according to campaign contribution data from the Florida Department of State Division of Elections. Verano, another medical marijuana operator, donated $2.5 million, while Curaleaf donated $2 million to the effort. In total, the campaign has raised nearly $72 million through August. Boris Jordan, the billionaire CEO of Connecticut-based Curaleaf, which is Florida's second-largest operator, agrees that the passage of Amendment 3 would have national implications as the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration is considering to reschedule marijuana under federal law. I think Florida going adult use forces the hand of the federal government to act, Jordan tells Forbes. How can you not? You have California, New York, and Florida. The last one would be Texas, and we're done. While 70% of Americans believe cannabis should be legal, according to a Gallup poll in November 2023, ballot measures in Florida need a supermajority of 60% to be approved, and various polls have predicted opposite outcomes. According to a July poll conducted by the University of North Florida, 64% of voters surveyed said they would vote yes on Amendment 3. This is slightly down from a poll conducted in late 2023, when 67% of voters said they would vote yes. In early August, a Florida Atlantic University poll found that only 56% of respondents plan to vote in favor of the measure. It's going to be a dogfight right to the end, says Jordan. Amendment 3 also has some powerful enemies. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is strongly opposed. During a law enforcement conference last month, Governor DeSantis told a room full of sheriffs that marijuana legalization should not be on the ballot and that the whole matter is ridiculous. It won't be good for law and order, and it won't be good for quality of life, the Republican governor said. Meanwhile, Ken Griffin, the hedge fund billionaire who moved his firm Citadel to Miami from Chicago in 2022, has also come out against legalization. Griffin, a Florida resident, recently donated $12 million to the fledgling Vote No on 3 campaign. In an op-ed published in the Miami Herald earlier this month, Griffin cautioned voters not to repeat the mistakes of states like California, Colorado, and New York, all of which have legalized recreational cannabis. No one wants the effects of widespread legalization of marijuana, Griffin wrote. Skyrocketing crime, suffering among children, a decline in the quality of life in Florida's vibrant neighborhoods. But Amendment 3 would make that inevitable. Interestingly enough, Citadel Advisors, which manages $63 billion in investment, has an $81 million position in a few companies with some exposure to cannabis-related businesses, along with additional bets, both calls and puts, as a hedge in case the stock prices go up or down, according to their latest 13P filing, which shows the firm's holding as of June 30th. Citadel uses this strategy across its thousands of positions in dozens of industries, from publishing to agriculture to financial services. Trulieve's Rivers, who's been leading the Amendment 3 effort, says she is not worried about DeSantis or Griffin. As she's been traveling Florida talking with voters, She says marijuana legalization is not connected to political affiliation. Support for cannabis has long been viewed as bipartisan. Everywhere from the I-4 corridor to the panhandle to southern Florida, the feedback that I'm getting from actual voters is that they really don't care what politicians think about this issue, she says. For them, it's a personal issue. It's a personal decision. The notion of party or political position isn't in the mix. The pro-Amendment 3 side also has an array of its own rich and politically connected backers. John Morgan, the founder of the personal injury law firm Morgan & Morgan, said during a press conference in May that he supports the amendment. Morgan also backed the successful medical marijuana ballot measure in 2016, earning the nickname Pot Daddy. I believe in the people of Florida. I believe they're going to legalize it, Morgan said. I believe it's going to be right. Roger Stone, a longtime advisor to Donald Trump, who is not part of the 2024 presidential campaign, also has come out in support of Amendment 3. I'll vote yes on Amendment 3 in Florida because the state's current medicinal marijuana system, approved overwhelmingly like by voters, is user-unfriendly, bureaucratic, restrictive, and expensive, Stone wrote on X in August. Yet another mistake by Ron DeSantis. But it is the former President Donald Trump, a Florida resident, who could tip a vote in either direction. During a news conference in August, Trump said that he's starting to agree a lot more with cannabis legislation and that he'll make a statement on Amendment 3 very soon. While he stopped short of a definitive stance, his comments veered toward the positive side. But as we legalize it throughout the country, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, it's awfully hard to people all over the jails that are in jail right now for something that's legal, Trump added. Curaleaf's Jordan believes Trump is the secret to getting the ballot measure approved. If Trump comes out in favor of support, says Boris, I think it's game over. Still, a lot can happen between now and Election Day, and cannabis legalization is hardly a key issue in the national conversation. Jordan says that Governor DeSantis, who did not want this on the ballot, will not go down easily. He expects to vote no on 3 campaign to get more intense. It's politics, Jordan says. It's a blood sport. Now we're going to go from cannabis to antitrust. This next article is from Politico, and it is about a major antitrust ruling. The title of the article is The Mount Rushmore of Antitrust Cases. It may prove to be one of the most consequential outcomes of Joe Biden's presidency. A judge ruled last week that Google had acted illegally to maintain a monopoly in internet search, the first major antitrust ruling against a technology giant, and one that could change how we all use the net. Judge Amit P. Mehta of the D.C. District Court has yet to determine the legal remedies for Google's years of spending, billions annually, to be the default browser on Apple and other platforms, and the search engine plans to appeal. But the ruling is still the most significant fulfillment of the high hopes within the antitrust community around the ambitions of a vaunted trio of officials with aims of reining in big tech. To unpack the ruling and its impact, West Wing Playbook spoke with Jonathan Cantor, who leads the Department of Justice's antitrust division. This conversation has been edited for length and clarity. Okay, for those who haven't been following, how big is this ruling and what will it mean? This is the most important case about the internet since the internet. The court concluded that Google is a monopolist and that it illegally maintained its monopoly. This is a victory for the rule of law, and it means that internet companies, like every other company in the country, are accountable under the antitrust laws, and that the values of competition and the competitive economy that delivers benefits to the entire public is something that we not only should care about in connection with the internet, but something that we should fight to protect now. They argued, Google, that their product was simply the best. And you convinced the judge that no, Google is illegally stifling competition. Why does that matter? A lot of people seem to like Google. All companies, including monopolies, do better when they face competition. Competitors force companies to deliver better products. They force companies to deliver less expensive products. They force companies to deliver more innovative products. We want the competitive process to work so that new companies, startups, innovators, small, medium-sized players can realize their dreams of building the next great innovative U.S. company. How will this change Google's business and the Internet? How will people experience the Internet differently because of this? We also want competition with respect to quality. That means search results can get even better, or can help consumers and users to better information on the Internet, and allow more information on the Internet to connect with consumers. Also, advertising is one of the most significant costs of American business, especially small businesses, who pay lots of money every year to generate customers through advertising on products like search. We want prices to come down so that those small businesses can generate consumers and build their businesses with all the benefits of competition, including price competition for advertising. Google became Google, at least in part, because of a DOJ antitrust lawsuit against Microsoft in the 90s. It opened up the early Internet. Some have suggested this victory has similar implications for AI. Do you agree? The beauty of competition and antitrust is that it doesn't pick winners and losers. It protects a process, the competitive process, that allows companies of all sizes and shapes to succeed. And so past antitrust cases, including the case against Microsoft, opened and paved the way for the next generation of Internet companies, including companies like Google. We want to make sure that those new startups, those new developers, those new innovators have the opportunity to reach the market. At the same time, we want to make sure that the existing large companies feel that competitive pressure and use it to drive them to produce more and to produce better for the American public. After the decision, the White House released a statement saying, "This pro-competition ruling is a victory for the American people, and that Americans deserve an Internet that is free, fair, and open to competition." Have you gotten any additional, more personal outreach from the White House after this ruling came down? Let me start by saying that our law enforcement is completely independent, and we follow the facts and the law. We bring cases based on the facts and law to ensure that we're holding companies accountable. Separate from that, I will say that the Biden-Harris administration has been the most forward-thinking, innovative, and impactful with result to competitive policy. It has supercharged the ability to infuse competitive policy throughout the government. Its executive order has allowed us to work more closely with the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Transportation, Health and Human Services, the NLRB, the Department of Labor, and so many others to make sure that competition is a value that allows and opens up our economy to the benefits of all. Since a transition in January is guaranteed, how does that change your work? Is there a rush to get things filed over the next 5 months? Again, we operate independently. And so my focus, day in and day out, is putting one foot in front of the other and making sure that we're fighting for the rule of law. No rush to get things filed now. We have and will continue to work at the pace dictated by the facts and the law. Do you think that this ruling is part of your own personal legacy? This is an extremely important moment to the extent that there were any questions about whether the antitrust law or the Department of Justice Antitrust Division is up to the task of enforcing the law on the Internet. I think we've answered that question decisively. This one goes on the Mount Rushmore of antitrust cases. The next topic we're going to look at isn't going to have any effect on you today, or tomorrow, or next week, or probably even next year. But it is coming, and it will be very, very significant. How significant is extremely difficult to forecast at this time, but it will be a major development when it comes to pass. So, what am I talking about? Humanoid robots. The article is entitled, "Six Humanoid Robot Companies Leading the Way in 2024." Now, I'm going to make a recommendation. After we finish this article, you'll have the name of 6 humanoid robots. I recommend that you go to YouTube, punch in the name of these humanoid robots, and watch them in action. It's extraordinary what they can do. And I'll give you the name of another humanoid robot. This is not a mobile robot. This is a robot designed to interact with human beings. The name of the robot is Ameca, A-M-E-C-A. Particularly look at that robot. The quality of interaction that they've developed with this robot is absolutely extraordinary. Okay, now we'll get to the article. 6 humanoid robot companies leading the way in 2024. The intersection of artificial intelligence and robotics has ushered in a new era of technological innovation, characterized by robots that can learn and adapt in real time. The dynamic capability transforms traditional automation, allowing robots to enhance their functionality across diverse and unpredictable environments, thereby revolutionizing industries from manufacturing to healthcare. The global market for humanoid robots is experiencing a significant surge, with projections indicating a potential reach of $38 billion by 2035. This growth is driven by advancements in artificial intelligence, reduction in manufacturing costs, and broader applications across various industries. Here are some key insights into the factors fueling the market expansion and the expected outcomes. Market growth. Initially valued at $6 billion, the market for humanoid robots is expected to grow more than sixfold by 2035, with an average annual growth of 70%. Cost reductions. The cost of producing high-specification humanoid robots has declined by approximately 40%, from $250,000 to $150,000 per unit. This reduction is attributed to cheaper component costs and improved manufacturing efficiencies, which are expected to lower further as technology advances and production scales. Increased demand in industrial applications. Humanoid robots are increasingly sought after for roles in challenging environments, such as factories, mining, and disaster rescue. Their ability to perform tasks in diverse terrains and under risky conditions makes them particularly valuable in industrial settings, where they can improve safety and operational efficiency. Consumer and service applications. Beyond industrial use, there is growing optimism about humanoid robots' potential in consumer applications. Advances in AI and robotics technology are expected to enable these robots to perform household tasks and assist in personal care, thereby addressing issues like labor shortages and the need of aging populations. Projected shipments. The expected shipments of humanoid robots are estimated to range between 1.4 million and 6.5 million units annually by 2035. This forecast is based on current technological advancements and market demand trends. Investment and development. Significant investments are being made in the development of humanoid robots, with major tech companies making major investments. These factors collectively suggest a robust growth trajectory for the humanoid robot market, reflecting broader trends in automation and AI across global industries. As technology continues to evolve, the capabilities and applications of humanoid robots are expected to expand, potentially transforming everyday life and work environments. Now, I'm going to read you the name of 6 humanoid robots, the major competitors in the market currently. Number 1, Figure AI. Number 2, Atlas, Boston Dynamics. Number 3, Optimus, Tesla. Number 4, Sanctuary AI. Number 5, Digit. And number 6, UBTech Robotics. Each of these robots represents a significant advancement in the field of humanoid robots, tailored to specific applications that leverage their unique capabilities. For instance, Digit from Agility Robots and Walker 5 from UBTech Robots are both designed for industrial applications, but differ in their sensory capabilities and locomotion techniques. Boston Dynamics Atlas exceeds in dynamic movements and is suited for complex environments where high mobility is crucial. As we look toward the future of robotics in 2024, the advancements by leading companies such as Agility Robotics, Boston Dynamics, Figure AI, Sanctuary, AI, Tesla, and Ubitech underscore a transformative era in humanoid robotics. These companies are not only enhancing the capabilities of robots to perform complex tasks, but are also addressing significant challenges such as cost, complexity, and public acceptance. The integration of advanced AI, improved sensory systems, and autonomous functionalities promises to expand the roles of humanoid robots in industries and everyday life, potentially revolutionizing the way we interact with technology. However, the journey is not without its hurdles. The high costs associated with the developing and maintaining these sophisticated machines, coupling with the ongoing need for technological advancements to ensure reliability and efficiency, pose significant challenges. Moreover, as these robots become more integrated into human environments, issues of ethical considerations and societal impact will become increasingly important. Addressing these concerns will be crucial for the successful integration of humanoid robots into our society and economic frameworks, ensuring they contribute positively to society. Here's a second article on humanoid robots. This is entitled Elon Musk's Optimus Robot Debuts at World Robot Conference, but doesn't do any robotic things. The World Robot Conference in Beijing was a marvelous exposition of our possible future and a showcase of how far Tesla's competitors have come. The World Robot Conference in Beijing was a show floor of wonder last week. Humanoid Chinese robots played the zither, folded laundry, and bested humans at the board game Go. As these modern miracles unfolded, Tesla's Optimus robot looked on, unmoving, from inside a glass box. The conference took place in Beijing and ran from August 21st to the 25th. Attendees were a who's who of Chinese robotic developers, and some were on hand to show off a vision of the future where humanoid robots do humanity's manual labor. The Astrobot S1 was there performing Chinese martial arts and writing calligraphy with a brush. The Galbot and Turai robots proved their worth by bagging groceries and moving soda cans around some shelves. Another company, Agrabo, promised it would begin delivering some of its machines to customers this October. While these machines puttered around, Tesla's Optimus stared at them from a glass case, surrounded by the company's electric vehicles. Optimus is a sleek-looking humanoid robot, but it hasn't done well in its product demos. Elon Musk famously unveiled Tesla's venture into robotics in the summer of 2021 by promising the company would soon put humanoid robots in people's homes. During the presentation, a stiff-looking machine walked on stage with Musk. It turned out it was just a guy in a suit. In a video, Musk posted to X showing Optimus folding laundry. Someone is just off the camera operating the machine remotely. The video had a big impact on the marketing of other robots, and it's typical for other companies to add a no-teleoperator label to their videos. The people making robots want people to know that the robots are moving independently. There's not much use to a slow-moving laundry-folding robot if you have to operate it yourself from the sidelines. According to CNBC, China has invested more than $14 billion into the robotics industry over the last decade. 27 new robots made their debuts at the conference, while Optimus looked on from his glass cage. Musk claimed that Optimus would roll into Tesla factories by the end of the year. Tesla will have genuinely useful humanoid robots in low production for Tesla internal use next year, and hopefully high production for other companies in 2026, he wrote in a post on X. The hype around robots is big, but it remains to be seen whether the cost of production will outweigh the benefits in the reduction of labor cost, let alone if Tesla can actually ship one. We're going to finish this morning with a couple of quick articles, the first on Eli Lilly's weight loss drug. Two of the biggest barriers for the fast-growing weight loss drug industry are cost and availability. Eli Lilly launched a new program Tuesday aimed at tackling both. The pharma giant will allow patients not using insurance to purchase obesity medicine Zepbound for a more competitive $399 per month, less than half the list price of other medicines used for obesity. The discounted single-use vials are self-administered via a syringe, while Zepbound is typically sold in an auto-injector pen. But all the vials will help increase supplies of Zepbound in the United States, the company says, although the FDA has listed drugs in a shortage for most of the year. And those of you who are going to be traveling this weekend, this is Labor Day weekend, good news for travelers over Labor Day weekend. Gas prices are expected to drop to their lowest prices in years, driven in part by lower demand. Gas Baddy expects Americans will save $750 million on gas during the travel period from Friday to Monday compared to last year, with the average price of gas per gallon predicted to fall by to $3.27 by Monday. And that's all we've got time for today, folks. Listen, thank you very much for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Steve Klein, and please remember the following points. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio on demand. You can also take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And finally, you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Thanks again, folks. See you next Monday at 11 a.m.